This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Joe Biden is making his first overseas trip as president. His meeting with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson could get a little awkward.
Before he became president, he's on record for saying that Boris Johnson was a physical and emotional clone of Donald Trump.
Also today, while the U.S. keeps marching on the path toward normalcy, much of the world is struggling to deal with deadly new variants of the coronavirus.
Wealthy countries are debating whether to vaccinate their adolescents, while healthcare workers in Africa have not had any shots for the most part.
And dirty air. It's what most of the planet inhales. Some Indonesians are suing their government to clean things up.
Every morning when I wake up, I see this blanket of smog hanging over the city.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to be with you today. Some words of advice from President Joe Biden this morning as he was departing from Andrews Air Force Base for his first overseas trip as president.
Watch out for the cicadas. I just got one. It got me.
Watch out for the cicadas. For real, last night a press plane following the president abroad was delayed 5 hours after cicadas clogged the jet engines. There are literally trillions of cicadas in the greater Washington area right now. Moving beyond the insects, Biden is heading to Britain for the G7 summit. He's first meeting with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. The last time a U.S. president visited the U.K., thousands took to the streets of London to protest. This time around, it's expected to be a more welcoming affair. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry starts us off today.
Cornwall in southwest England is on virtual lockdown this week, so it was hard not to notice some early arrivals. V-22 Ospreys were spotted circling above the small seaside resort where President Biden will be staying. Thousands of police have been sent in from across Britain and accommodation is tight. So tight, in fact, that a cruise ship docked off the Cornish coast is housing hundreds of police officers. It's the largest security event this part of Britain has ever experienced, and some of the locals aren't happy.
We've been affected in quite a major way, to be honest.
Kate Harrell runs the Bean Inn, a vegetarian restaurant located on the road into Carbis Bay, where the G7 summit is being held. You might think having so many world leaders in the one place would have restaurants overflowing. But between all the road closures and security checks, Harrell tells me things aren't looking good.
For us, we're normally a fully booked restaurant every night and we're very, very quiet over those 3 days, unfortunately.
Locals in Cornwall might be unhappy, but one person who must be relishing the moment is the British Prime Minister. Having Biden come to the UK on his very first overseas trip as president is seen as a win for Boris Johnson. After all, rumour had it that Biden wasn't a fan of Johnson.
Before he became president, he's on record for saying that Boris Johnson was a physical and emotional clone of Donald Trump.
Stephen Fielding is Professor of Political History at the University of Nottingham. Top of the Prime Minister's agenda will likely be a new trade deal with the US, Fielding says, something Johnson promised would happen post-Brexit. Biden has made it clear that any disruption to peace in Northern Ireland caused by Brexit could scupper that trade deal. But Fielding says Johnson will make his meeting with Biden seem like a success, no matter what.
So basically, Boris Johnson wants to be able to come out of the room with Joe Biden, and he probably will anyway, because Boris Johnson is capable of saying black is white and white is black, that he's assuaged Joe Biden's concerns about what's going on in Northern Ireland, and that this has laid the foundations for a really good trade deal with the United States.
Johnson is also expected to appeal for the US border to be reopened to UK visitors. But with the COVID-19 Delta variant now dominant in Britain, Biden will likely be reluctant. The US president's visit isn't just about meeting with Boris Johnson. Leaders of the G7 countries will be there too, along with heads of state from several G20 nations. Julie Norman is with the Centre on US Politics at University College London. She says Biden's meetings with these other leaders may be more important for this trip.
The fact that India, Australia, South Korea will all be there is quite crucial for Biden's larger foreign policy vision of trying to tilt or pivot more towards Asia and towards the Asia Pacific. I think the fact that all of those three states are going to be represented is intentional for both the US and the UK and how they see their broader foreign policy agenda.
Norman says Biden's trip is also about fixing relations with traditional US partners after the Trump years. The global vaccine rollout and economic recovery are expected to be high on the G7 agenda. And like most of these big summits, there will be protests. Climate change activists rallied in West Cornwall on Saturday.
There's a climate emergency. It's an emergency we want all the G7 member states and their four guest countries to acknowledge next week.
They marched across a beach and into the water to raise awareness about rising sea levels. The protest group Extinction Rebellion wrote an open letter to local residents to apologise for the disruption they're likely to cause this week. Chris Bird is with the Environmental Campaign Group.
It's not our intention to disrupt people's lives in a year when they've already been so disruptive. But we're already seeing crop failures and massive storms. When those sorts of things start to hit Cornwall, it'll make any disruption that we cause by having a march in the street very easily forgotten.
Bird says he knows that the world leaders may not see or hear their protests, but he hopes the American president gets the message loud and clear.
It's marvellous that Trump is no longer in power and sabotaging things, but Biden needs to do far, far more than he's actually doing already. We are in a crisis. There's no doubt about that.
That's the Whirly Tube Orchestra, as Bill Banks-Jones calls it. He's the artistic director of the Tete a Tete Opera Company. The Whirly Tubes are made out of abandoned fishing nets, and the sound is created by spinning them up in the air. Hundreds of volunteers will gather to perform on a beach opposite the G7 summit on Saturday afternoon. The Whirly Tubes might seem kind of frivolous, but Banks-Jones says there's a serious message for global leaders here.
If we get them out on that incredible sweep of beach, breathing the air and stopping for 10 minutes and taking the time to consider the beauty and the fragility of the environment they're in and playing them a kind of plaintive song with these tubes, then I think we really will leave them with something they'll never forget.
Before leaving the UK, Joe Biden will be making one final stop, Windsor Castle, to meet with the Queen. Then it's off to Brussels for a NATO summit before he heads to Geneva and faces what might be the most challenging part of his trip, a face-to-face meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The US government is turning over migrant children to local police. Cops are being brought in to deal with kids who act up. That's according to a new investigation from our partners at the public media program Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting. With us to discuss the investigation is Reveal reporter Laura Morell. How did you and your colleagues come across this information, Laura?
Hi, Marco. Well, we've been reporting on how migrant children are treated within the government's shelter system for a few years now. And my colleague, Aura Bogado, actually did a story last year after she obtained some federal records that showed that many children, thousands of children, were in prolonged detention in these government shelters. And it was through that data that we were able to identify several cases, at least 84 children that were transferred to local law enforcement custody in the last 6 years. And these are children ranging in age from 11 to 17. And we found cases across the United States, but primarily in the state of Texas.
Right. So at least 84 kids and happening. It's widespread, it sounds like.
It is widespread. It's a bit concentrated. Our data shows and records we were able to obtain show between two shelter providers, Southwest and BCFS, which have shelters in the state of Texas. There were two counties also in particular that we saw a lot of cases in, Cameron County and Bexar County.
And when these kids are said to be acting up, what are we talking about? They're being violent or are they being kids?
They're being kids. And what the documents show is that many of the children were turned over for allegedly fighting, breaking into fights, damaging property. You know, in one instance, there was a television that was broken. In another, it was a couple bed frames, and also, you know, some mental health challenges as well. Most of the children were processed for misdemeanors. And I think it's also notable to mention that at least 10 youth were charged as adults. So those are some examples of some of the cases that we're talking about.
That's pretty disturbing. And this is happening with local police. Which government agency is supposed to be responsible for these children?
You know, these are unaccompanied migrant children, children that, you know, come to the border to seek asylum. Immigration authorities transfer custody over to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is a government agency, and it's charged with overseeing this system of shelters that care for these children across the United States. I think right now there's about 100 privately run shelters. So they're in federal custody. And what's interesting here is that these children who are in federal custody are, you know, being discharged over to local law enforcement custody. In some cases, you know, we found instances where, you know, kids were in juvenile detention or in adult jail, because like I said, some of these were charged as adults for, you know, a day or two. Sometimes it was weeks. We know of some cases where children were sentenced to jail. These are kids that are in federal custody, but are now in local law enforcement custody, away from the system that's supposed to be protecting them.
Laura, how aware is the Biden administration of how these children are being dealt with? Have they responded at all to your investigation?
We reached out to the Office of Refugee Resettlement. We also reached out to Javier Becerra, and they did not agree to an interview. They sent us a statement saying that they wouldn't comment on anonymous allegations. And to be clear, as we mentioned in our story, these are not anonymous allegations. We have public records, we have federal records, and we have videos, body cam footage that show what happens when police are called to these shelters.
It seems these kids ought to have both some kind of legal protection since police are involved, also some kind of psychological or counseling support. Is any of that happening?
Right. So under something called the Flores Settlement Agreement, and this is going back, you know, a few decades, back in the 1980s when a lot of children were fleeing violence in El Salvador and were ending up in shelters here in the United States, this settlement agreement is basically a court decree that's designed to safeguard migrant children from neglect and abuse. And there are certain guidelines that the Office of Refugee Resettlement has to meet in terms of their care, in terms of offering counseling and access to legal services and, you know, things like that. It also calls for the government to release children from its custody, quote, without unnecessary delay.
Laura Morell is a reporter with Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Thanks for telling us about this investigation, Laura.
Thank you so much.
Remember when TikTok users kind of freaked out last summer?
Hold on, wait, don't scroll. All right, now that I've got your attention, you might know that there's something going on with TikTok right now.
Rumors have been spreading that TikTok might get banned in the U.S.
because they think China is going to steal our information.
Horrified TikTokers reacting after then-President Trump signed an executive order seeking to ban the app from the U.S. Why? Because it's Chinese-owned. The Trump administration claimed Beijing could use the app to spy on Americans and steal personal data and demanded it be sold to an American company or get banned from the U.S. TikTokers like It's John Walsh were not having it.
Our TikTok community is in crisis. We need a president who will not threaten Charlie D'Amelio's career, who understands we are classy, bougie, and ratchet. Who
knows? This TikToker goes on to endorse Biden for president.
Let's put him on our For You page this November.
Hi, kids. I'm Joe Biden. And if you vote for me, you can keep your tickety-talk.
If you want to save TikTok, vote for Joe.
Together we can keep TikTokin'.
Today, TikTokers who did vote for Biden saw the dividend. President Biden revoked Trump's order by signing his own today. The U.S. will now be required to conduct security reviews of foreign-owned apps. The apps that Trump wanted to ban, like TikTok, can still be used by Americans for now. That also applies to WeChat, another popular Chinese-owned app that Trump wanted to ban. So keep on with your renegade, whatever that means. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A marathon, as you may know, is a running race 26 miles long. An ultramarathon is any race longer than that, sometimes much longer. when 21 runners died in an ultramarathon in China a few weeks ago, the racing world was rocked. But as the world's Rebecca Kanther reports from Shanghai, even before the tragedy, runners there have been concerned about problems in the sport.
Liang Jing was a champion ultramarathoner. In China, they called him a running god. So the news that he and 20 other runners had died while racing in Gansu province a few weeks ago was sobering.
Every trail runner, it's such a small community here, it hit home. And a lot of us realized, especially us more advanced runners, that could have been us as well.
Kate Hill had shared the winner's podium with Liang Jing just 6 months ago. She's an American trail runner in China.
No one really seems surprised because, like, we all know how much the trail running world is lacking in safety here.
Hill says she learned that firsthand in 2018 at her first 100-kilometer trail race.
In the middle of the storm, mudslides, I was doing river crossings up to my chest. Looking back on it, that's still to this day one of the most dangerous races I've ever done. I remember running along a cliff ledge. I felt like I was going to be blown over a few times off the cliff.
Ultramarathoning is a dangerous sport, and runners accept a certain amount of risk when they compete. But Hill says she's seen race organizers cut corners to save money.
So that means usually what lacks is safety. So instead of having like an appropriate amount of medical personnel on site, they'll have only half that, if any at all. Instead of having three ambulances, they might only invest money in one instead.
Running as a sport has only just taken off in China in the past decade. There's a rising middle class. You just need a pair of shoes. And the government supports healthy lifestyles. Promo videos like this one draw in runners with promises of beautiful scenery and prize money. It's a new way for local governments to attract tourism. Liu Yong is a professor of mountain sports tourism at Chengdu Tourism University. There's been a trend in trail running here of who can put on the longest race or the most challenging course, he says. This becomes very dangerous. There just isn't enough education yet about how to prepare for mountain trail running. He says the runners in the Gansu race lacked experience, but the organizers definitely share the blame. A video made by a photographer who was there shows Liang Jing and other top runners running in shorts and light jackets. Poor planning by race organizers left many runners unprepared when extreme weather hit, and the organizers missed the chance to call off the race. The runners died of hypothermia. Will Ford is a sports writer who's interviewed China's top ultra runners. He says they're strong athletes who are increasingly competing on the world stage.
The one thing that they lack is the experience of trying to mitigate and manage and understand risk in the mountains when it comes to weather, which is a pretty lethal combination.
Racing casualties actually are common here, runners say. Just a few weeks before the Gansu tragedy, a runner died from cardiac arrest during a race in the Gobi Desert. The day before that, during a 500-kilometer race, a runner died of hypothermia. In response to the tragedy, the government has issued a ban on extreme sport competition. But Ford says that leaves more questions than answers.
Well, what is their definition of extreme? I think they're still figuring that out.
Liu Yong, the sports tourism professor, says he thinks the ban won't last long, maybe 3 months. I think the approval process for organizers will be much stricter, he says, especially about safety measures as well as qualifications for runners. But I hope there will be more training and education about mountain sports for both organizers and participants. After the tragedy, Kate Hill and other runners in Shanghai ran together in memory of those who lost their lives. They want this to be a wake-up call for the sport worldwide.
We're all really kind of itching to be back on the mountains. This is our passion. It's what we do. But we all kind of have this agreement. We would rather have races be canceled and postponed than just have nothing done about the safety measures.
Sadly, those 21 runners who lost their lives in Gansu won't have that chance. For The World, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
There's another race happening in China. One of the 15 elephants there have been walking through forest fields and even a bustling city in southwest China. As we reported last week, these Ellies have become social media stars, with everyone asking, where are these elephants going?
Where they're headed
is not as important as understanding why they're headed there.
Joshua Plotnick teaches animal behavior and conservation at Hunter College in New York.
I think that the biggest issue that these elephants are facing is lack of resources and pressure from human habitation.
Plotnick says his fellow elephant experts are working on theories as to why the elephants are on the march.
At some point, you reach a threshold where the elephants make a judgment call. I hate to be too anthropomorphic there, but they are weighing costs and benefits, and they're making risky decisions to decide that now is the time that we need to go out and find other resources.
And they need a lot of resources.
Elephants eat upwards of 250 kilos of food a day. And, you know, once they get a taste of a high quality food that's planted in a crop field, for instance, it can be very difficult to deter them away from that.
How can you keep them down on the farm after they've dined in Paris, right? Plotnick says that as far as he knows, neither the elephants nor the people they've encountered have come to harm. That's mostly thanks to the cooperation between police and citizens. And while authorities are keeping one step ahead of the herd, Plotnick says scientists need to look back to the home territory the elephants left behind.
Scientists really need to look into why they may have left this location in the first place. And once they figure out why they left, come up with ways to satisfy those needs so that either the elephants want to return there, which would be ideal, or they find other suitable habitat in which the elephants can live safely.
Thank you for the update, Professor Plotnick. Joshua Plotnick there. He was speaking with our colleagues at the CBC program, As It Happens. El Salvador has become the first country in the world to make Bitcoin legal tender alongside the U.S. dollar, the country's currency. President Nayib Bukele says Bitcoin will make it easier for Salvadorans living abroad to send money home. Others warn about the volatility of Bitcoin. This is the kind of story you're going to read about in our newsletter, Top of the World. It keeps you informed about news headlines across the globe. Subscribe to it at theworld.org/newsletters. For just a second time, an Olympic refugee team will compete at the Summer Games to raise awareness about the 80 million people who are displaced worldwide. For a young swimmer from Syria, it is a lot of pressure.
Then I remember that we, this small team, is representing so much hope.
We meet some of the athletes still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. There's good news today in the fight to help vaccinate the globe. The White House is said to have made a deal with Pfizer to provide 500 million doses of coronavirus vaccine for about 100 countries over the next 2 years. President Biden is expected to announce the deal at the upcoming G7 summit in England. The White House has been under pressure to do more to address worldwide vaccine shortages. Those shortages are especially acute in less wealthy nations, where the spread of highly contagious new virus variants means that for many, the worst of the pandemic may be yet to come. That's according to writer Zeynep Tufekci. She's an associate professor at the University of North Carolina. I asked Tufekci why the Delta variant of COVID-19, a strain first identified in India, has just gotten a lot more ominous.
We recently got data from the United Kingdom that indeed it is more transmissible, which is terrible because transmissibility is an exponential threat. Plus, to make things worse, it also appears to be more severe. The combination, something that can spread really rapidly and is also more severe, is catastrophic for a lot of countries for a variety of reasons, have either had mild outbreaks until now and don't have mass vaccination. In essence, they're sitting ducks because they haven't had any chance to build immunity. And something like this can burn through their country like wildfire. We saw this happen in India. We saw this happen in Nepal. And I'm really worried for the rest of the world, as bad as things have been here, which was terrible. There were a lot of places that kind of escaped it, and we didn't completely understand. There might have been a sort of combination of factors. But right now, it could just be that this tips it over for them too, and then they get very rapid outbreaks.
And was the Delta variant critical to this recent massive surge in cases in India?
The UK data is very much suggesting that's exactly what happened. And there's a lot of countries that are in the same position India was a couple of months ago, essentially sitting ducks. And this is a terrible thing to imagine because it would mean the pandemic would end sooner, because all pandemics end, but in a tragic way, because millions, maybe billions, get infected before they have a chance to be vaccinated.
what you're saying, Zainab, if I have this right, that ultimately more people might die of COVID after we have vaccines that could save them.
That is absolutely correct. And this is what's been gutting me, because we had this before with HIV/AIDS. More people died of HIV/AIDS after we had drugs that worked to save lives. And we may have a repeat of it in a way, in that we have vaccines that could help save all these people. And we haven't increased the supply, nor do we have a sensible distribution system. I mean, yes, of course, I completely support access to vaccination by everybody, including adolescents. But wealthy countries are debating whether to vaccinate their adolescents, while healthcare workers in Africa have not had any shots for the most part. What we need is for the world to lead, for the United States, including, you know, the sort of big vaccine producing countries, and say, we are going to do everything in our power to take over every last bit of spare capacity and figure out a way to increase the supply any way we can, as soon as we can. You know, we have US and Canada and, you know, Europe, we've ordered vaccine supplies many times our need. We're vaccinating our teenagers while the rest of the world is just sitting ducks for this potential catastrophe. And I feel that it's a moral stain that we've not really grappled with what we're doing and what we're not doing. And in countries like ours, people can just walk into a pharmacy and get vaccinated. So we're going to forget about the terrible reality that the pandemic is far, far from over.
So here in the vaccine on demand part of the world, I mean, I see in Washington State, you'll get a joint if you go in for a shot. How much should we be worrying about breakthrough cases? I mean, if I'm vaccinated, do I still need to worry about my own health because of variants?
This comes down to how you view risk. The other coronaviruses that are endemic, they just cause us mild colds and we get exposed to them as children and our immune system knows what to do with it. So once you're vaccinated, even if you see a version of it, a breakthrough case that just produces symptoms, we should watch to see if some breakthrough cases become severe or cause death. And but from all data I've seen, that happens not only very rarely, it happens especially among the elderly, but that is just a fact of being elderly. The elderly sometimes have fatal outbreaks from the common cold. A vaccine doesn't give you immortality. The immune system gets weaker as we age. So what I've seen is really encouraging. So personally speaking, if I had tested positive before I was vaccinated, I'd be worried till I was completely out of the woods. Whereas right now, as a vaccinated person, if for some reason I was tested and found I have a positive, which means the virus is just a little bit replicating in my nose or something like that, I view it as a curiosity personally. And unless something happened, I wouldn't even think about it.
Zainab, for the U.S. and other countries that are well vaccinated, there is obvious national self-interest in seeing the rest of the world vaccinated quickly. But as you said, many African healthcare workers even have not been vaccinated. In South Africa, not even 1% of the population is vaccinated. Help us understand why Western countries don't seem to make that connection to as many people as possible on planet Earth getting vaccinated.
I don't understand it either. We let millions of people die from AIDS, even when in that particular case, it was even more of a moral stain because the drug was easy to produce and we didn't even let them. In this case, it's not easy to produce. We need proactive intervention. We need ideally the White House to lead, not just say, here's some donated vaccines, which is good. And we don't care about patents, which is good too, because this is such a complicated thing. Like handing me a recipe for a croissant isn't going to do anything. I cannot make a croissant, even if you give me the recipe for it. It's a bit like that. You need expertise and supplies and this and that. Vaccine production is very difficult and we need to help increase that capacity. And we're not doing it. And billions of our fellow humans are at great risk. And I'm not saying we should do this because some variant may hit us in the future. I think just morally speaking, that shouldn't even be the reason we think about this. It's something we can do. It's just money and it's just effort. Like nobody's asking us to go take huge risks. And we're not even doing that, I think partly because we don't feel as much risk anymore. And I just find that tragic.
realistically, what is the end game? Or do you see a future end up with very different end games for the haves and others for the have-nots?
So the end game is that everybody in the world is likely going to encounter this virus in one form or another, probably fairly soon. And that is either through vaccination or infection. If we sit on our hands or do very little, billions of people are going to encounter this virus through infection and all the risks that entail. So I don't see that it's going to be necessarily prolonged, because the idea that all these countries are going to be able to hold all of this off with mitigations while they wait for vaccination for years, that's not true. They'll have outbreaks and they'll get infected. So the end game is everybody's going to encounter this virus one way or another, and we have an affirmative choice on whether that's going to be through vaccination, the humane way our science allows, or through infection, which is a catastrophic option, in my view, to let happen. So that's the end game. I'm just being like, this is kind of this very clear, realistic thing that I don't think we talk about enough.
Zeynep Tufekci is an associate professor at the University of North Carolina and a writer for The New York Times and The Atlantic. Zeynep, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay, take a deep breath with me. If that is clean, fresh air you're filling your lungs with, consider yourself lucky. According to the World Health Organization, 90% of human beings breathe in polluted air. That's because so many people now live in megacities where the air keeps getting dirtier and dirtier. But there's one city in Asia where citizens have an audacious plan to clean things up by forcing politicians into action. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
Some cities sort of hum along, but Jakarta growls. That's the roar of traffic in the capital of Indonesia, where 24/7 cars and motorbikes and buses spew black clouds that foul up the air.
Every morning when I wake up, I see this blanket of smog hanging over the city.
That's Adityani Putri. She goes by Ditri. And she lives in a high-rise in downtown Jakarta, where even the skyline, big towering skyscrapers, are obscured by this gray veil of smog, the color of dirty dishwater.
4 years ago, I was able to see them from my balcony, and now, you know, they're barely visible.
Jakarta is one of the most polluted cities on Earth. There's no mystery why. It's also one of the most crowded. It used to be a tropical port surrounded by fishing villages. But like many Asian cities, its population has exploded. Close to 30 million people now live in Greater Jakarta, like the whole population of Texas crammed into one giant city. Ditri says the pollution, you can almost feel it in the air.
You wipe off your face and you have a thick layer of soot on your face, and that's, you know, increasingly becoming the norm.
We just can't take it anymore, she says, because it's not just gross, it's asthma, it's cancer, it's kids who get sick when they play outside. So now a small group, 32 people, is so fed up that they're suing the president and members of his cabinet, plus Jakarta's governor. Now, suing the head of state over dirty air, that has happened in the West, notably in France. But it's a more gutsy move in Southeast Asia, where most governments are authoritarian. So was Indonesia until about two decades ago, when it shifted to democracy.
No, it's a novel idea. Never really, it's not a tried and tested approach in Indonesia for sure.
Most of the plaintiffs are environmentalists, like Ditri, who is supporting the lawsuit as an expert. She runs a nonprofit, Yayasan Indonesia Cera, which pushes for clean air and energy. And the problem isn't only traffic, it's coal plants and factories, some making food, furniture, and gadgets that end up on American shelves. Ditri blames the government for failing to plan for a clean future. But I ask her, really, will the president, Joko Widodo, come take the stand?
We don't dare to expect the president to actually, but it would be awesome. It would be a great show of support for the cause.
In other words, probably not, but his lawyers do have to show up. Now, if judges rule in the plaintiff's favor, there's no cash payout. It's not about that. The courts will simply say the citizens are right and the government is negligent and must do something, like using the World Health Organization's definition of polluted air. Right now, the Indonesian standard is three times higher than the global one.
And that's unacceptable, because there is no way that Indonesian lungs are
3 times stronger than the lung of a normal human being.
That honesty could drive action, forcing the government to shut down coal plants or limit traffic in parts of the capital or stop putting factories next to schools. Parents, rich and poor, fear that their kids will have stunted lungs or even brains from growing up in foul air. Dietrich worries about her young daughter.
She is 10 years old. It's really hard for me to kind of like let her spend copious time amount outdoors because of this worry. It's constantly on my mind.
What's remarkable here is these citizens suing the president, they might actually win. They're not asking anyone to fix some big amorphous problem like climate change, but just want to make their city cleaner.
It is tipping in our favor. So we're really, really hoping that the court will rule in our favor and support most, if not all, of our policy recommendations.
The court ruling is expected Thursday, and if the citizens win, that could inspire people in other cities to demand more from their leaders. All they're asking for is air that won't make them sick. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
As the U.S. continues its withdrawal from Afghanistan, there is no pause in the violence. Late last night in the northeast part of the country, a deadly attack on workers clearing landmines. Masked gunmen shot people working with the Halo Trust, an international nonprofit. 10 employees are dead and 16 are wounded. Afghanistan's interior ministry is blaming the Taliban. The Taliban is denying any involvement. Our next guest knows the Halo Trust well. In fact, while working for the BBC in Afghanistan in 1991, the organization helped keep him alive. For you regular listeners, you'll recognize his voice, longtime former member of the World Staff, Chris Wolf. What's your reaction to this news, Chris?
I was devastated, Mark. I was actually awake when I saw the news drop at about 2 a.m. Eastern Time, and it was like a bombshell. I can't believe it. The Halo Trust is an incredible organization. Since 1988, they've cleared hundreds of thousands of landmines and unexploded bombs and shells in Afghanistan, saving countless lives, and I count my own among them. And of course, it's dangerous work, and they've lost people along the way, but this is by far the worst loss they've ever suffered.
Chris, what is the story behind the Halo Trust, and what kind of work have they undertaken over the years in Afghanistan?
Well, Halo stands for Hazardous Areas Life Support Organization. It was actually founded by a former British Army officer called Colin Mitchell. In 1988, he began a new life trying to help ordinary people affected by war. With his military background, he decided on demining and recruited a bunch of former officers from the British Armed Forces to go out and train and lead teams of deminers. Halo now has almost 9,000 employees around the world, and about 30% are in Afghanistan. 98% are locals, like all of the victims in last night's attack.
Why are landmines such a problem in this area of Afghanistan? Do you know when they were placed and by whom?
In a nutshell, it goes back to the Soviet occupation in the 1980s. Both sides laid mines everywhere. The rebel Mujahideen got some from Pakistan with CIA backing, but most of the mines by far were laid by the Soviets and their communist allies. They left millions of landmines in the ground. Now, some with batteries died, some with wooden casings rotted away, but most are activated mechanically by pressure. So in a dry climate like Afghanistan, they'll last for decades. Every year, 2,000 to 3,000 Afghans are killed or wounded by them.
How do you physically demine an area? What is that process like?
Easiest thing to do is blow it up, Marco, you know, if you know where it is. The Soviets kept actually very good maps of their minefields, but unfortunately they were all lost during the Civil War years in the early 90s. I talked to an ex-Halo guy who'd seen them and handled them and praised their quality. Then there are mine detectors, which are basically metal detectors. But those won't work if the mines are made of plastic or wood. If you suspect those are present, then it's the old-fashioned man on his knees with a knife probing the ground to try and find them.
Chris, I said earlier the Halo Trust kept you alive when you were in Afghanistan for the BBC years ago. Explain your personal connection to the Halo Trust.
Well, it was my first day out of the capital, Kabul. My BBC colleague and I were traveling in an aid convoy with a couple of mine experts. And as soon as we hit the city limits, we came across an armored personnel carrier that had just been hit by a huge anti-tank mine. The scene was awful enough, but then you get the realization that the road you're on is mined. The mines are buried sometimes like five together, very deep in the potholes. So the mine guys I was with had the experience, skill and confidence to somehow navigate us through that mined road. But more directly, an hour or two later, we made a pit stop in an open field, and I can still see it. I started walking toward a copse of trees to go relieve myself when one of the Halo guys physically grabs my arm and pulls me back and yells, where the hell do you think you're going? And I quickly learned that you can never go off the pavement or tarmac road if you can at all avoid it. That's a privilege denied the farmers and their families who have no choice but to go out into the fields. And it's a tough life.
Chris Wolfe is a journalist and a writer, formerly with the BBC and The World. His book, Bumbling Through the Hindu Kush, A Memoir of Fear and Kindness in Afghanistan, will be released in September. Chris, great to hear from you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Marco.
Nearly all of the votes are counted, and the presidential race in Peru is still too close to call. Socialist candidate Pedro Castillo is just barely out in front with the very smallest of margins, but the right-wing Keiko Fujimori is not conceding yet. It seems likely that a legal battle is where things are headed. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia is with us to get the latest. Jorge, just how close are we talking here with these two candidates?
Oh, extremely close, Marco. Pedro Castillo is ahead by not even a half of a percentage point, but almost all the votes have been counted, so it seems likely that he is going to win this contest. But as you mentioned, his opponent, Keiko Fujimori, she's a right-wing former member of Congress, she is challenging some of the votes. And at the same time, there are some 300,000 votes that are still being counted. And so this is so tight that these two factors could effectively flip the race in the other direction.
Do we know how credible those claims of voting fraud are?
They're not very credible right now. Fujimori's party is accusing Castillo supporters of stealing votes. But at least as of today, Wednesday, they have not provided very strong, concrete evidence. And at the same time, this race was just a couple of days ago, and there were international electoral observers who said that this race appeared to be a very clean race. Now, Marco, this isn't the first time that Fujimori comes this close to becoming president. She lost by like a quarter of a percentage point 5 years ago. So it seems very likely that there is going to be vigorous arguing and uncertainty over who officially will be the next president of Peru.
Remind us who Pedro Castillo is. What would be the significance of a presidency if he wins?
Well, Pedro Castillo would be the first president in at least 20 years to come from very humble working class origins. He is from the mountains. His parents are illiterate peanut farmers. He lived in his hometown his entire life. He worked until recently as an elementary school teacher. And he was able in his campaign to tap very directly into a division that there is in Peru between rural Peru and urban Peru, mostly between Lima and rural Peru. In his public appearances, he shows up with a straw hat because he still farms. Even his accent, his cadence, is something that is usually associated with farmers, but not with the political and the economic elite of the country. So regardless of what the official result of this race is, his campaign is a significant moment in the country's history, and it is something that political and economic elites, it is something that they are very much paying attention to now.
So either way, Jorge, Peru is going to have a new president with the world's highest per capita COVID mortality rate. What kind of Peru will the new president inherit?
Well, first of all, the new president will inherit a very much divided Peru. This race is extremely close and is symptomatic of that. Also, public health-wise, the country is in a very difficult situation. People in the cities are disciplined about wearing not only masks, but wearing double masks. A lot of buildings have requirements for face shields, and yet the country still has the highest per capita death rate in the world. At the same time, the country's economy has been battered by the pandemic way harder than most countries in Latin America. So the new president is going to face political challenges, public health challenges, and economic challenges for the next 5 years.
Yeah, very tough road ahead. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia with the latest on the presidential election in Peru. Thank you very much, Jorge.
You're welcome, Marco.
With just 44 days until the Summer Games in Tokyo, the International Olympic Committee has just announced another delegation, the 2020 Refugee Olympic Team. These are athletes who fled their home countries but still want to compete on the international stage. The first Refugee Olympic Team was formed for the Rio Games in 2016. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on this year's roster.
IOC President Thomas Bach announced the athletes by name.
Ala Masu, Khamun Derafshipur, Jovat Machchup, James Nyang,
each person was joining via video call and finding out they made the team in real time. Selection was based on athletic performance and confirmed refugee status, among other criteria. This year's team consists of 29 athletes competing across 12 sports from 11 countries. In Tokyo, they'll march together under the Olympic flag. But each athlete has a distinct story, including the team's first badminton player, Aram Mahmoud from Syria. Mahmoud left Syria for the Netherlands in 2015 as his country's civil war made him unable to train or go to school. He's been practicing just outside of Amsterdam ever since and says he feels lucky to make the refugee Olympic team.
This team is very important also for other people to give him motivation to like work hard, and there's nothing impossible to reach your dream.
One of Mahmoud's teammates will be 800-meter runner Rose Natike from South Sudan. When Natike was 10, her family fled South Sudan on foot during the civil war. They arrived at the Kakuma refugee camp in northwest Kenya. Natike started running and hasn't stopped. She says she's seen how sports can help unite people from different nationalities.
So when we meet in sport, through football, basketball, or running, at least make us to interact together, and that can bring peace because anyone can change his or her life through sport.
Tokyo will be Natike's second time at the Games. She was the team's flag bearer in Rio.
Refugee Olympic team!
When we march into the stadium, it was our happiness when they just cheer at us. We feel we are human beings like others.
Venezuelan boxer Eldrick Sella will get that experience for the first time this summer. He lives and trains in Trinidad and Tobago, where he says not a day goes by that he doesn't dream about the Olympics, even when he's not at the gym.
When I was mixing concrete, I was thinking how that would help me in my boxing career. When I was cutting grass, I was thinking how that would help me in my boxing career.
Other athletes on the team include cyclist Masuma Alizada from Afghanistan and sports shooter Luna Solomon from Eritrea. The IOC says the team is meant to bring awareness to the plight of nearly 80 million displaced people worldwide. Team member and Syrian swimmer Yusra Mardini says that's a big responsibility.
Sometimes it's a lot, to be honest, to take on. And sometimes I want to be a normal teenager or a normal person. But then I remember that this small team, is representing so much hope, not only to refugees, but to lots of young people around the world.
Mardini added that ideally there wouldn't be a refugee Olympic team. But this is the current reality, she said. And she and her teammates are going to make the most of it in Tokyo. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
On that inspirational note, we say goodbye to you on this Wednesday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be right back with you tomorrow.